Good afternoon, everybody. Ruchim Abayim. On the first...
Excuse me, one second.
Yes, Carol.
Moderator. People know they're in the Pew Center.
I'm going to announce that. Oh. And I've handed several out. So Okay. Thank you so much for preparing them.
Okay.
All right. So, right, what Carol is alluding to is stacks of a 16-page abridgment of a recent Pew study on the generation we are discussing this afternoon, on millennials in adulthood. And we'll say more about that in just a moment. But let me have your attention just so I can introduce myself and the panel, and we'll get started. If you have your cell phone with you, which I assume you do, pardon me? You can't hear me so well? There, better. If you have your phone with you, please turn it to silent. So we're very happy you're here. I am Joel Alter. I am Director of Admissions for the Rabbinical and Cantorial School at JTS. And Carol asked me to moderate this for two reasons. One, because of the orange pants I'm wearing today, which she was very inordinately enthusiastic about in the halls of JTS. And you think I'm kidding. And because in my role in admissions, I, of course, see a lot of millennials, but also Gen Xers on the way in. And she thought that I might have a hope of moderating this session successfully. On the panel are three rabbis, but you see only two, because poor Lizzie Haydeman. Say hi, Lizzie.
Hey there.
All right. Lizzie is stuck in Chicago due to the vagaries of weather and the policies of Spirit Airlines. So we are... let's start with introductions. And Lizzie, why don't you go first? At this stage, just tell us who you are and where you are serving.
Okay, so I'm really, really sorry. I wanted to be there with you, everybody, very much. And I don't usually say this, but I really don't recommend Spirit Airlines. Don't fly.
Okay, thank you. David?
I'm David Singer. I am a rabbi here in Dallas. I work at Cherith Israel, where we have barbecue like last night every day of the week. I'm founded in Build Makom, which is a young adult community here.
I'm Rachel Kobrin, and I am at Congregation Agudas Achim, which is in Austin, just 3 hours away, but a whole cultural experience away from Dallas. And I also, I'm leaving this summer to begin as a senior rabbi at AJ, Adoth Jeshurun, in Elkins Park, right outside of Philadelphia. At CAA, I began a few different initiatives, which particularly have reached young adults, which I'll speak about today.
Terrific. So our hope is to cover some ground, answer some questions in series for the first portion of the meeting, but then really leave it open to a lot of Q&A. That's how we hope this hour goes forward. So let's first get definitions out on the table. And speaking of out on the table, for those of you who just walked in, there are handouts of a Pew study relevant to our topic out on the tables near the front. So Gen Xers, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 47 years old. It's the generation born post-baby boom up until about 1980. That's what folks are calling, demographers are calling Gen Xers. Millennials are those born between about 1980 and 2000. So the youngest of the Gen Xers, of the millennials, excuse me, are still in their teens. The oldest are in their early 30s, on the brink of their mid-30s. All right, so that's what we're talking about. Think about your community, and that's our focus this afternoon. What I would like each of the panelists please to do is describe the community, or in your case, David, the sub-community that you are cultivating, that you are leading. So describe your community, its demographic, and its goals. Let's start with that and try to get the color of each community, and I'll ask each of our planned questions in sequence. So your community, its demographic, and its goals. Lizzie, why don't we start with you?
Okay. So Mishcom's original goal, honestly, if I'm being totally honest with you, was to create a place for me to die. And what I mean by that is, you know, I was committed to being in Chicago because it's where I'm from, and I felt a strong sense of relationship to this place. I really wanted to be here. And when I started asking around for what community I would join, you know, like where would I go to find the kind of ecstatic prayer experience, the kind of young progressive community. I was single, I was 30 when I was moving back here a year after medical school. I wasn't even thinking about where I would serve. I was just thinking about where I'm when I wasn't doing whatever work I might be doing. And I didn't want to take a pulpit job that was going to restrict my social life because I felt like I was young and single and wanted to explore what it might look like to be a young Jew. Just to be a young Jew in Chicago. And ultimately, the answer that I got from people was that there was no community that fit that profile of, you know, the sort of intersection of focus on the development of young adults with spirituality as its focus. You know, there were young adult organizations, but they were primarily social, and there were synagogues, but they weren't young adult-oriented or focused. And so Mishcom was born at that, you know, intersection of wanting a real deep spiritual experience that I felt that I was in a position to help create because I was coming off of an internship at ICAR, and I play guitar, I sing, you know, I sort of thought I can create that. And the demographic group of people that I would be hanging out with anyway as a social event. So our demographic group, to answer the question specifically, is people like our leadership. So I'm in my early 30s. We have a lot of people in their early 30s. We have an intern, we actually have two interns that are in their mid-20s. We have a lot of people in their mid-20s. As a group, I would say, began with those demographics because we were the leadership, but then also, you know, behind the scenes I was working with Rabbi Michael Siegel, who's really from Ashan, that really encouraging starting this up, and he actually referred me to some people in his community that were not adults at all, were in their, you know, early 50s and, yeah, early 60s, people who we just thought would be helpful in creating. And so we actually also have a whole group of people who are baby boomers. The community meets two Friday nights a month and one Saturday morning. I've been teaching classes in response to need. You know, when people say, I don't really feel like I have a daily practice and I don't know how to explore a daily practice, how would I do that?
Lizzie,
so I'll create a class.
Lizzie, forgive me. Lizzie, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You just said something very important, and I want to make sure everyone in the room hear it. Can you repeat what's the frequency of meeting?
Sure. We meet two Friday nights a month and one Shabbat morning. The first Shabbat morning of the month and then two Friday nights. And it is possible in the next couple of months we will add another Saturday morning. But at least right now, that is what I personally can manage as a leader. And I also think for the community people we're serving, that is an appropriate amount to expect in order to create the experience we're trying to create, a quality experience, create the energy of the experience we're trying to create. Anyway, we started that young group, and I think we're continuing to grow in that, and we're growing especially in the area of young families, and boomers too. Our goals really are to create invigorated, inspired Judaism in Chicago. That's our cover sticker, inspired, down-to-earth Judaism in Chicago. And, the mission statement is to engage, or specifically an outreach-oriented organization, engage, educate, connect, and inspire people in Chicago, and notice not just Jews, but people in Chicago through dynamic experiences of Jewish worship, learning, and community building. So we begin to educate, connect, and inspire people in Chicago through dynamic experiences of Jewish worship, learning, and community building. And that's really what we do. In a way, we function as a liberal class because, there are no requirements or systems around membership. We invite people to contribute to the community. In a way, I do feel like we're kind of a bridge between birthright mindset of everything being free for young adults and the synagogue mindset of you paying membership dues and, there's sort of things you get in exchange for being a member. Our dues structure, you could say, is designed with the young adult in mind. And then for the older members of the community and the more financially mature community, I think there's kind of an understanding that a larger portion of the weight falls to people who actually can afford to support the vision of what we are trying to do. And for them, that's important. So that's the community, that's our demographic, and our goals are engaging and creating, inspired, educated Jews in Chicago.
Thank you. Rachel?
Okay. So first of all, I thank you for having me on this panel. I'm really looking forward to, we're going to be doing some questions and answers at the end, and hopefully this will grow, especially because this is a small group, into more of a discussion, because I'm sure that, I'm going to speak a little bit about my conservative synagogue in a city and sort of how we've sort of thought a little bit out of the box in terms of reaching millennials, and I'm sure that you have stories as well, and I look forward to hearing them also. So I'm at Congregation of Gudas Achim, which is on the campus of the Jewish Community Association of Austin. And so we're located in Northwest Austin, and on that campus is the Federation and the Day School and other synagogues, a number of other synagogues, and also JCC. And so this is an awesome vehicle for connection for multiple communities. It really is like the shul with the pool. You can literally hop from a minion to minion on a Shabbat morning, go to lunch at one shul, and then jump over to the pool on a summer day. It's pretty great. The interesting issue is that all of this is in Northwest Austin. And many of the young adults who are moving to town, there was a study done a few years ago, and they cited that more 25 to 34-year-olds were moving to Austin than anywhere else in the country. And although they are moving throughout the city, there's a particular area in Austin, South Austin. There's an emblem in Austin, the sort of bumper sticker, or what they sell in the airports are T-shirts and mugs and shot glasses that say, "Keep Austin Weird." That's our slogan, and that comes from 78704, which is the zip code of South Austin. That's South Congress. That's where sort of the hippie, earthy, liberal vibe is really headquartered. And so the Jewish community is really in Northwest Austin rather than South Austin. So one of the pieces that I want to talk about a little bit today is a satellite that I began in South Austin called Sela. And Sela, like Lizzie, like you spoke about, Lizzie, we don't just reach people in their 20s and 30s. Certainly, we also have many people who are deeply committed to it who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s. But what we have found is that it has certainly spoken to folks in their 20s and early 30s in that sort of millennial group as well. How much detail do you want to go into right now? Sorry, I want to just clarify that.
Right. The you know, plans are just that, they're plans.
Yeah.
What I want at this stage, the next questions I'm going to be asking, so maybe it's already okay for you to fold it in, is, again, who is your, please describe your community, its demographic and its goals. I'm interested in where your community meets. You've begun to address that. And what does your community do?
So here's the thing. I want to talk about four different aspects of my community congregation in Gudas Achim. So this is just one of them.
Okay.
So let me just say like another minute about Sela, and then we'll come back to it. So we began as Sela meeting at Casa de Luz, which is this like funky macrobiotic center. It has a restaurant. It has rooms you can rent. It also has like yoga and, you know, natural hair coloring and all sorts of different funky things. It was like the perfect place for us to start meeting. And we outgrew it like the minute we started. The first time we met, we had over 100 people and we were like out the doors basically. And so we actually stayed there because we were like better to be, you know, really out the doors for as long as possible than to move. So we actually were there for about a year. Then we moved to a second site and now we're in a third site. We now meet in sort of there's a church which is located a prime location in South Austin that has sort of a separate building, which is like its sort of social hall wing, and we take that over. It's not really a social hall, though. It's really more like a multi-purpose room. It really has no glamour to it whatsoever. The coolest part of its visual aspect is that when you look outside behind, you know, for the, we sort of sit in like kind of a semicircle scenario, but when you look forward, when you're facing east, what you see is the playground because there are lots of windows and we always have babysitters out there, especially, you know, during the winter months. During the summer months when the sun sets later with kids. And it's a great playground. So that's actually a nice visual. So we meet there. We also meet in other places. We meet in homes and at a variety of other places when we're doing other non-Shabbat experiences. We also, Sela actually started a Hebrew school. We're going to have 4 Hebrew school classes next year. We've had 3 Hebrew school classes this year. This is a Hebrew school, which is you do not need to be a member of our congregation to send your kids to. And this has reached a tremendous number of people and has a capacity we know to reach many more who are just not joining shuls and are sort of maybe at the cusp, at the end of that millennial group. So the central prime sort of vision of starting Sela was also to create a davening experience which was filled with vibrancy, which was musical. We have sort of a musical ensemble, which we particularly call a musical ensemble and not a band because they're not a band. We have definitely rehearsed with them and they're excellent. We have, being in Austin's amazing because there are so many musicians there and they're professional musicians who are willing to just volunteer their time for this because they feel like this is really their spiritual outlet. But they're not a band. They're a davening ensemble, and they facilitate a prayerful experience, and they facilitate a room that is filled with song. And so that, you know, that's a big piece. Participatory experience, an experience that's filled with meaning and that provides meaning for this, for those who attend. And again, I think we'll come back to some of this in the next questions. And I want to just highlight my other categories, but we'll come back to sort of some of the primary goals and sort of how we've reached them in terms of Sela. The other 3 pieces that I want to talk about are our shul also started a few years ago a group called ATX Havara that meets in people's homes that is particularly for 20s and 30s. So it's really particularly for this demographic. And we, again, found that we had tons of people coming. We davened Kavlat Shabbat, but not Mariv. So it was davening the Psalms of Kavlat Shabbat and then having a big potluck dinner. And the goal, and a bit of Torah learning as well, and the goal was that this was not just going to be sort of your average like young adult come together and have dinner, but rather there is going to be something substantive, something that was grounded in Judaism and grounded in Jewish experience and meaning in sort of a transformative, prayerful experience. And that also, the challenge that we began to have with that was that we were actually filling people's homes to capacity, and it was began to be hard to find homes that could hold the number of young adults that were coming. So that's the second thing I want to, and then the third thing is a program that we partnered with other shuls in the community, as well as with the Federation, our Torah on Tap program, which happens in restaurants and bars around the city, and, you know, hot topics, hot Torah topics, studying and learning with young adults. And we found that that in particular has also reached a number of young adults. When I do it, there are usually 50-plus young adults who will come out on a weeknight to learn Torah.
Can you give us an example of two hot topics you've addressed?
Sure. So I can actually give you more than that. I've done Judaism and vegetarianism. I've done Judaism and social justice. I've done Judaism and gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender issues. I've done Judaism and intermarriage with a reform rabbi, those kind of things. And then the fourth thing that I would love for us to get to at some point is Tat Shabbat. And the reason why I highlight Tat Shabbat is because the end of these this age bracket, of our millennium age bracket, are people who have five-year-olds about, right? 5 or 6 year olds. And the reality for most of these people, or many of these people, is that they left shul when they were teenagers, and this is their entrance back. And so what I have found in my work is that Tat Shabbat is really not for a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. It is really for the parent who is walking back into the shul because they have a 2 or 3 year old. And that when we enable the Torah that we teach to really reach people on a variety of levels, when we feel so purposeful in the Torah that we're creating in that room, when we're teaching them something that they can take away and bring back into their homes, we're actually reaching those parents in ways that are really profound and enable them to create community within our space. So those are sort of, and I'm, you know, we'll come back to the more specifics of those.
But thank you. Thanks David. So much, David.
Hi, it's really good to be here, and hi, Mark. Really good to be here and talking with y'all. You're sitting right now in actually North Dallas. 10, 15 years ago, all of the Jews in Dallas were moving from North Dallas to far North Dallas, or far, far North Dallas, or if you go beyond that, actually, you basically hit Oklahoma. So what we found over the last 2 decades was this movement of Jews north. That's where the other conservative synagogues are, other than Cherith, which is just obviously up the street from us right here. And that's really where the center of most Jewish life in Dallas is. At the same time, in the last decade, what we've seen is this resurgence of young life down south of here in an area called Uptown, an area called the M Streets, an area called Lower Greenville, which are all parts of the urban core surrounding downtown Dallas. And that's where the majority of young Jews, and by young I mean anywhere from 21 straight back from UT up till 40 or even beyond that, are living. What was the funny thing?
I'm just chuckling because I almost make the break.
Almost. So Joel is not invited to live there, but everyone else does. I moved here 2 years ago to come and work at Cherith, and one thing that Cherith was very interested in was beginning to think outside the box and reconceptualize the way that it does engagement and outreach work, also appreciating the fact that Cherith is located in probably the worst location it could to do any of the work that it's trying to do. All of the young families that it tries to engage with are in far north Dallas, and anyone under that is in south Dallas, or is farther south in Dallas. And what it found was that actually Cherith had no ability to successfully and on a large scale engage with young adults. And certainly the last thing that it could do was actually ask them to come in the building, because that was not happening. Because what we found and what Macomb has been predicated on is the assumption that actually the question of how can we bring in millennials is the wrong question. And it's actually the question that's always going to fail. Right? The question is actually, how do we bring the Torah we're trying to teach to millennials? And it's actually not about millennials, that's really about most people, right? Because most Jews aren't joining synagogues. And so Cherith had the wisdom and the foresight to be able to incubate this idea, this young community that I would build, which is not actually, it's not a sub-community of Cherith. It is a separate community sponsored and incubated by Cherith. Makom is about building a makom, building a place for Judaism, for Jewish life, that is without pretense, that is energized and exciting and fresh, but while deeply meaningful and authentic and just true to who who each of us are, to exist and to thrive in Dallas, centered around its urban core. Like Lizzie, when I moved here to Dallas, I really actually was also just looking for other Jews my age, and looking for a community with which I could talk Jewish, daven, enjoy Shabbat. That doesn't exist in this part of town. And so I got here and sent an email to about 30 people between the ages of 25 and 35 that I could grab their email address on, saying, here's the vision. Here's what we want to build. We want to build a new look for Jewish life for our peers in Dallas. We want to actually take the synagogue out of the synagogue and build something which can feel real, which can feel integrated with our lives and offer a Torah that is deeply personal while also allowing us to translate it into the ways that we integrate with Dallas. And I invited those 25, 30 people to join me for a night and just talk about this vision. A week later, we had a community room down near SMU that was filled with 100 people really energized and excited about the idea. And that night I asked people to put a little trust in me to help us to build something and give us the next year to do it. What we built in that year is Makom. Makom is a hub, a laboratory, we call it, for energized Judaism, a place where we try to tear down walls, right? Tear down fear and tear down guilt, tear down judgment, and actually build community that is deeply engaging and welcoming, but that is also infused with a Torah that speaks to people. We do that right now in a space that we rent down near downtown, which is a funky space where it has a rotating art gallery and walls that are painted with whiteboard paint. And so every Friday when we go there, that's where we hold our Shabbat programming. We go there and we literally cover the walls with our own art and with our own ideas and with our greetings. And we build a community. And this community, we've engaged over 800 people in the last year and a half. And what really we're just trying to do is empower, outreach to, and then inspire a generation of Jewish learners and leaders and doers who we believe can actually fundamentally change the Jewish future if empowered and engaged to do so now. Shereth recognizes that the long-term implications of what we're doing, if and as it is successful, will result ultimately without question in a higher likelihood that any of these given people will one day join Shereth. But Makom is not a membership or outreach driver. It is not meant to be, and it never will be. The goal is actually to build a stronger Jewish life, build stronger Jewish community that is empowered and feels a level of ownership over their Jewish lives like never before, because that is actually a strategic plan which necessarily helps Shereth immeasurably and beyond and in practical terms has beyond anything we've seen so far.
Terrific. David, can you just summarize, because I missed it and maybe others did too. Clearly you're doing Friday nights. Are you doing other services too, and with what frequency?
Makom meets twice a month on Shabbat. Once a month, all of Makom comes together. Once a month, we come together in small groups in various people's living rooms simultaneously across town. We gather for learning and for holidays and celebrations. We, on average, basically, Makom is meeting in some form or iteration once a week, either on a Friday night, Saturday night, or sometime during the week.
But not Shabbos morning?
Not Shabbat morning.
Okay, thank you. Lizzie, obviously, we went deeper in this first round than I gave you the opportunity to do. So take a moment, Lizzie, and think. I know I didn't ask you the question of where does Mishkan meet, but think about what you heard from Rachel and David, and if there are similar details you want to fill in now, please do.
Sure.
Because
of the really nice connection with Anshan ran the synagogue early on. Michael actually, Rabbi Siegel, really insisted in a way, if we're going to do this independent project, we want to be very independent, but also show that we are connected to and supporting the established spaces in the city, and at the same time as hosting services, on the beach and in, art studios and in living rooms, we also had a consistent once a month gig in Ashamit where, on the last Friday night of the month, that's where we were. And when we are at Ashamit, continuing, even now, the crowd we get is a little bit older and more comfortable with synagogue space, I think. And what that does also for the people who might have found us somewhere else in some less conventional space somewhere else in a different part of the city, because we do also host events all over the city, as David described, McComb is very much a product of changing demographics in Dallas. Michigan's also responding to the changing demographics of young Jews in Chicago, and part of the mission is to meet young Jews where they are, and much of the spaces where they are in these up-and-coming, cool, newly gentrified neighborhoods that have no Jewish infrastructure. So we make it a mission to go and be in those places. At the same time, it's also kind of bringing people back to Ashamit once a month, which I think builds a nice connection to and familiarity with the synagogue, the synagogue structure, and doesn't trying to say, we're creating something that is in defiance to and, opposed to the establishment, the opposite. We want to, create actual connections between, what we're doing outside the walls of synagogues, which we all know is very important, and inside too.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
I know as I take notes, a very clear picture of certain commonalities is emerging. I mean, just for starters, and this is both the most significant and the least of what's been named, this is an urban phenomenon, clearly. There's much more to say. But what I'd like the three panelists to do now, to give a narrative, to round out the portrait of some of the people you would call typical to your communities, because obviously it's not monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to think about what is your Torah for your demographic? What is your Torah for the demographic? Another way to think about that same question is what attitudes, what assumptions, what needs do your demographic present you with? Maybe you can tell an anecdote that challenges you or calls upon your training. All three of you were trained at Ziegler in LA. That calls on your training in the conservative movement in distinct ways, right? Is there an anecdote that helps us, that will help us understand what do they need? What do you teach? How does it challenge or call upon your conservative training in particular ways? So it's not an easy question, so think about it for a moment and see what you come up with.
So so the thing that sticks out to me the most is there's sort of this image that I have in my head, and that's of the 13-year-old who sort of, was really bored in shul and, was looking up at the lights or the stained glass the whole time and sort of got through becoming a bar bat mitzvah and then left and never came back. And then they step into our services again. And these are people who generally have gone off to become doctors or lawyers or teachers or psychologists and are actually, incredibly successful professionals in their field. And they walk back into a synagogue and they feel like they're 13 again. And nobody wants to feel like they're 13, even when they are 13, right? And that's just a horrible, horrible feeling. And so and in general, I think that as rabbis, if we want to really meet the needs of this next generation, we have to have that in our minds. And so that's something that I really that's really been a focus for me. What does it mean to reach people who are highly intellectual, highly engaged in the world around them, yet their Jewish knowledge is really that of a 13-year-old, and they don't even know what page they're on? They can't read the Hebrew anymore, and they don't know what page they're on. And so, you know, one of the premise of our community is everything we do, we have transliteration. So our service is in Hebrew. You know, it's a Hebrew service, lots of nigunim, lots highly participatory with transliteration. So everybody is on the page. And, you know, I walk people through lots of kavanot, you know, many sort of intentional opportunities to guide people through the service. The other piece and I think that this answers your question, it's sort of just a value that I hold, is this notion of I do not want to be the kind of rabbi who needs to be in a situation where I am leading services that I would not choose to attend. That's sort of a value. I saw my mentor for my internship here from when I was in rabbinical school, and I remember this conversation I had with him as I was leaving, you know, to apply for jobs, and I said, oh my God, I can just see it, like I'm going to be an associate somewhere, I'm going to be like on this high bima and leading these services, and it's just going to, I'm not going to be able to do it. And he said, you'll do it for 5 years and you'll be okay, you'll survive. And I said, my soul will die, and I like banged the table and probably moved the hummus, which is like on the table. And he was like, yeah, you'll survive 5 years. So I hadn't seen him and just ran into him again here. And I was like, he was like, see, your soul didn't die. And I said, actually, I'm in a place with pretty good services. But the story comes up for me again because I'm moving on to a new congregation. And so, you know, that's something which has stayed with me. And something which I feel like has been incredibly important in all of the pieces that I have run, whether it has been literally down to a taught Shabbat program or Sela for high holidays. That what I want to be doing is something that's very intentional and that's authentic. That's authentic to who I am as a leader and authentic to what I think the community that I'm building is. Because I really believe that the reality, you know, again, we're speaking about millennials, but it could be communities that are beyond millennials. That the reality is that the people that are attracted to the communities that we are building, there's a reason why if you go to a big city, there are a lot of people who go to one synagogue and a lot of people who go to another synagogue down the street, and they look very different. Because the reality is we're not all going to be attracted to the same kind of prayer or the same kind of learning. But as leaders, I think we need to be leading the kind of prayer and learning experiences that are truly authentic to us and the communities that we want to build. And so that is really where I've come from. I think that the Torah that I teach is, you know, is meaningful Torah to me. Honestly, I heard a session earlier where people talked about teaching what's meaningful to them as well. It's also meaningful Torah that I believe is going to be meaningful for the community that's there. You know, it has a social justice bent to it. I think that I've always heard that rabbis teach what they need to hear themselves, and I think that that's a piece of it. I think that for the millennial community in particular, that they certainly connect to the notion of the brokenness in our world. And the fact that that there is loneliness, deep loneliness within our communities and within individuals. And so I think that as rabbis, you know, for me, what I've really seen is that when I teach a Torah that speaks to what it means to heal that brokenness, both in communities and in individuals, when I speak to what it means to be lonely and to find community and to find connection and how Torah is about that, I think that really speaks to this community in particular, because I think that they are looking for meaning. Whether they're going to yoga or going to Buddhism, they're going to something, they're looking for meaning. And if we can provide something that's transformative, that can speak to that meeting, then I think that Judaism can speak to them.
Great. I think that young people can smell inauthenticity from a mile away. And I think that if we pretend to be authentic rather than just be our authentic selves, and if we teach a Torah which is not a Torah that we would buy, or try and build a community which is not one that we want to be part of, as Rachel just began to speak to, we're really acting like frauds. And so what is crucial to me, and to answer your question, Joel, what is the Torah that I'm teaching through Makom, is that all of this stuff, all of this Torah, all of this Judaism, this whole enterprise, it has to be deeply personal. It has to be absurdly authentic. And if it's not so real that I can walk with it into a bar and into the grocery store just as much as I walk with it into my house, then there's a disconnect there that is actually intrinsic to the problem. And the fact that I may struggle to walk into the doors of a synagogue is really just a symptom of that. Either because I'm so afraid of what's going on in the synagogue, or because walking into a synagogue makes me feel like I'm supposed to strip myself of everything that is me and act a certain way. Right? So you know, some anecdotes to explain this, like people ask us, you know, how they're supposed to dress when they come to First Fridays, one of our Shabbat programs, and we tell them, awesome. Right? Like, look good, either in pajamas or in your suit, but like, come as you are. Right? And come as you are is something that we're preaching from the roof to yelling from the rooftops at every point. Right? This has to be real, which allows us then to, our demographic is made up of a wide range of people. People who grew up in very traditional homes here in Dallas, in what is a very large frum community, all the way to people who are either transplants to Dallas in a community that is actually very centralized and stagnant and doesn't have many transplants. We have found in a year and a half the amount of converts and potential converts who have felt welcome through this community is from my perspective actually quite remarkable. And that it ultimately our success relies on people actually feeling like we believe what we're doing. I refuse to pretend.
This is great. I want to know, does that mean explicitly ditching pieties? Help us understand, because your frame is really clear.
My leadership has been clear. They don't want things like transliteration, and they don't want things like English in davening, which is actually quite weird to me because I expect to want to push them. When I'm saying I think we should like have a drum on Shabbat, I think I'm like actually just kowtowing to what their needs are, and they all rebel and say no. They actually want to daven in Hebrew, even though most of the people in the room have no idea what's going on because of all the symptoms we've just discussed, which means that anytime we get together and daven, I actually have to start by giving everyone permission to not know what the hell is going on and to go down a road with me and with all of us to try and experience a level of intentionality and inspiration, either through the Hebrew we don't know or through the tunes we can learn or through a process of actually picking up on melodies and words and ideas. It means that We very intentionally and specifically create a space for people to say, I don't believe in that Torah, right? And that's okay. And actually, there's a lot of truth there. And I, David, your rabbi, also have some of these same struggles because we walk that place together. Just one other anecdote, just because you said something, Joel, about how we're all urban phenomena. When Macom started, the space we were using for one of our Shabbat programs, because we had no other, was my backyard. And what was funny about that is I don't live in urban Dallas. I actually live in very suburban Dallas right here. I live next door to where George W. used to live. Like, this is WASP Central suburban Dallas. And what we found was on a Friday night, we had 100 to 150 cars lining down Del Norte Lane in Preston Hollow of these Jews coming out to do Shabbos. And what was even funnier was actually all my neighbors really got in on the gig for a few months and would like start directing cars to David's house for Shabbat. What that told us was fascinating, right? As much as what we were doing was to every extent possible bringing Judaism to the people, bringing Jewish life and everything that we built to the places that people were, actually our people were very, very much open to traveling to get to it. Right? And so we've held events in the most far-fetched places where I would never send myself, let alone my child. And people have gone to it because they're excited and interested and willing to take that leap of faith, so long as we don't actually ask them to just take a leap of faith and drop their rational self at the door when they walk into my phone program.
Great.
Can I put in a little plug just for Lizzie and also for the Sidor we use? So I know that you just said that you don't use transliteration. So for those who are interested in like a traditional, fully translated siddur. Katav has a for Friday night, has a siddur. It's just called Kabbalat Shabbat. It's a red, hardbound, really like the pagination is lovely and it's really easy to follow. And Lizzie had an intern who created, who basically transliterated the key pieces of a Maksor. So for High Holidays, we've been able to use a traditional Maksor and then use the supplement that Lizzie's intern created for those who need the transliteration to be able to participate and sing.
Terrific.
We're really happy to share that with people.
All right.
Although I will say, and this wasn't going to be my whole point, but we were using Siddur Sim Shalom, which was great for all the people who grew up with it, who loved that Siddur because it has all these happy memories associated with it from Ramah, you know, and USY and all that. But, you know, the thick one, not often Sim Shalom, is not so friendly for people who don't read Hebrew. So, you know, we printed a translate booklet for, you know, any service we were doing, which was helpful for sure, and people appreciated it definitely. But ultimately, we ended up purchasing Siddur Eight Ratzon. I don't know, Rafael, if that's the one that you were just talking about.
No, we have a different one. But talk about it. I'm curious.
All right. Lizzie, I'd actually like you to address the other question I asked because we're moving well into our Q&A time here. So what is your Torah? Or tell us an anecdote. Who, you know, help us understand how you are bringing your training to bear, meeting the needs of the people you're serving.
Okay. You know what? Just because that was the middle of a sentence, I'm gonna segue that into the answer to your question.
Go ahead.
Which is when we finally got a book that had both Hebrew and transliteration fully and completely on every single page. Everybody was so grateful and so appreciative because what it meant was every single person, regardless of their background, could participate, and nobody was identified as other. You know, nobody had to hold the transliteration booklet separately and feel like self-conscious about, you know, their own lack of knowledge. And I think many people, as I was describing, come into, you know, Jewish space feeling their own sense of lack of knowledge and inauthenticity, whether they went to day school through 12th grade, you know, or you know, in many cases, I just see many people who really feel like they don't know anything, you know, they went through 13 years old and never came back. And so people are coming in with this, like, fear, you know, like, for fear of dipping the toe back to spiritual space, but also hunger, you know, like deep yearning for meaning and for social connection and spiritual connection and looking to the Jewish community to provide that. And, you know, so I feel like, I feel honored and almost like it's a daunting task for somebody to come in. You know that you might have one chance to inspire and to connect with their spirit, you know, and unless they maybe walk out again and don't come back for another 30 years or ever. And so I feel like the message consistently is one of permission to be wherever you are, you know, to wherever you are on your emotional journey of the week, you know, whether it's sadness or loneliness or elation, you know, wherever you're entering this space from, that's where your prayer begins tonight, you know, and really speaking to the emotional experience of where people are, and then connecting that to Torah, but not exactly, not the other way around. And, you know, I'm sensitive now, so when I go into worship spaces, and the way that services are done is like, and we now turn to Lechazos, and welcome to Sabbath Bride on page 29. For somebody who doesn't, like, what is the Sabbath Bride? What is that about? You know, how does that connect to my spirit? So I feel like the Torah, you know, that I find myself teaching on a regular basis in different ways is connecting what is happening in the soul of the people in the room or myself, or, you know, what's happening in the world with the Torah, if that were.
Right. That's great. Thank you. What I would like to do now is what I'm calling the rapid response round. And really, if you can just help us see a direction, right? We don't have time now for this anecdote, but just to put a marker on the wall. Communications. How do you communicate? Is it a newsletter? Is it Facebook? Is it an email list? Is it something else? How do you communicate? How much in advance do you plan each event you hold?
Facebook, word of mouth, email list through the shul, and email list through a separate Sela email list for Sela events. Also a lot of one-on-one, you know, a lot of one-on-one engagement.
Thank you.
Website, email, Facebook. Word of mouth.
Lizzie?
Same.
Okay. Interfaith. Non-Jews. Major presence, minor presence?
Yes.
Major.
Lizzie, we didn't hear you.
Major,
okay.
But one of our thought partners is a community here called Life in Deep Ellum, which essentially aims to take the church out of the church in Deep Ellum. And the pastor there, this guy Joel, and I have become very close in building our communities parallel to each other.
Okay. Israel. Is Israel a nuclear button or fertile ground?
Fertile ground.
David says it's fertile ground. Lizzie?
I think it's both.
I think both as well.
Okay. And I hesitate to ask this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Distinctive vocabulary. We've heard a lot of it. You folks have used very distinctive vocabulary. So are there words that feel central to how you do what you do? And significantly, are there words like, oh, I don't know, halakha, that you never utter?
You know, it's funny that you chose halakha as one of the unutterables. I find the opposite. I actually think people are really thirsty to know the traditional approach to things. And so halakha I'll use frequently. Inspired, deep, powerful, transformative, spiritual. Those are all words that are frequently used. Ecstatic, quiet. You know, words that describe certain phenomenology, emotional experience. I find myself using those words a lot,
sure.
And I'm very careful with hot button words. I don't actually talk about Israel all that often because it is so emotionally charged, mostly in a negative way for people.
I would echo all of Lizzie's words. I'd probably add soulful to that, but you'd probably add that too. And I would say that the words that I avoid talking about a supernatural interventionist God, and I'm very careful about the God language I do use. We talk a lot about God being sort of the godliness within us, the God that works within communities and sort of within nature. But I would say that's a very distinct difference. And halakha, I would agree with Lizzie. Halakha is not something I would avoid. Being sort of irreverent with the text in a very reverential, with reverence, I would say, is something that I don't avoid. I think that's something that we do, you know, really taking apart the text. But I think that's the piece, you know, sort of the godliness, God piece is. Something key.
Thank you. David.
Empower, inspire, and then a word we use very frequently is simple. Everything we do has to be simple. We don't touch the word membership. And we talk a lot about halakha, but what I will never use is the words must or should. It's about what is the halakha. I can answer that question.
Right. Here's a question I hadn't thought of before. I'll ask it now. This is my final question, and then to you. Do you find yourself teaching primarily from Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, other literature? Is that a useful category for it to help paint a picture?
I mean, I find myself teaching. So when I teach, I'm actually thinking particularly, well, actually any of the groups that I've talked about. So, you know, oftentimes it will start out with a parsha, but it usually has Midrash or a piece of Talmud that's connected with it. I'll often pass out like a little piece for people to discuss. I love when I can turn the room into a Beit Midrash and then come back and have, you know, and really sort of sum it all up. I love when there can be participation, and I think that when people can engage the Torah the same way they engage literature in the rest of their lives, and the same way they might engage, you know, another kind of another intellectual pursuit that they're engaged in, and engage it instead with their heart and mind and soul, I think it is very powerful. So yes, I do. I use all of those, and in even Shulchan Aruch.
Great. I would say there's no method to the madness of what text I use other than I tend to teach what I like, and I like Talmud, so I teach a lot of it, but I try and keep that well-rounded.
And Lizzie?
Same. But that also approaches the answer to the question of what specifically from being trained in a conservative seminary we all are bringing.
Right.
You know, I think that we all have to learn so much Gemara and Midrash in the traditional, in the, you know, Hebrew, Aramaic. I think that is hugely important in the authenticity realm. And people are hungry for that, and that stuff is deep and cool and complex, and I think people are into that. So to the degree that I can draw on all of that, I do.
Whew. Okay. Well, you guys did great. Thank you. Questions? I always like to try to pool questions together. I find it more efficient. So I'll start from the back. Larry. Oh, yeah. Good point. Thank you. Thanks for the reminder. So Larry, come on up. And please try to keep the questions brief.
Yes, David. Larry Baser, Framingham, Massachusetts. Hello, and start of the year, Lord. Two challenging questions for you, for both, for the panel. One, I am the last generation, I'm 51, I'm the last generation of a baby boomer. I see all that you're doing. It is great, it is wonderful. I see light is what's going on. But one challenge that I'm feeling, and I ask those who are close to my age or a little bit older and wiser than I am, are we too old to be able to do the integration that you folks are doing? Because sometimes I feel that. That's one. And two, the challenge I see is that you are urban / city based, where I'm in Framingham, Massachusetts, your typical shrinking suburban synagogue that, aside from the frig about the money, they only want to see what converts into membership. So I agree, it's a dirty word. But they want to know what they're going to get. My synagogue, the officials are going to do with that. How do we then go out and reach, besides from sort of taking the synagogue out of the synagogue to reach people? I love all that. I agree. But ultimately, suburban congregations that are still trying to say, why are we really conservative? What's going on? And my final question is, Fidel, how much do you push halakhic, what you do for Shabbat and boundaries? Do you let them do what they want to do when you're in your community? So if it's past sundown, are they still writing on the whiteboard, etc.? How liberal are you? Sorry, those three questions.
Terrific. Let's get, because the time is short, let's get the questions on the table.
Okay. How big are your teams and how often do you miss?
Wait, can you ask that again?
How large are your leadership teams?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have teams? How big are they? How long do they meet? And then what's your turnover? Are these people who are there for the long haul, or is it someone's new, someone's gone every time? How do you have any kind of stability if it's a revolving door? And if they're staying put, how do you change over time? And then third one, dating in the group, is it a positive or negative force?
So I got to find out a lot about my phone through them, even though they're way past their generation, obviously. And I was able to adapt and create my same 30 programming off of my phone, so I want to thank you publicly for that. My two questions are, number one, a lot of the conversation has been revolving around Shabbat, and I'd love to hear about what happens programs that are not Shabbat. And number two is, it's like the dirty word, but how do you deal with this as compared to Chabad, who's trying to do similar things? Are they infringing? Are they trying to take your people? I know that can be an issue in all of our communities, so I'd love to hear that as well.
This is great. I've got the list of questions, so we can review them, but keep them coming.
Our area is somewhat less urban, and really we're starting to not think the only young adults we know are the young adults who go to the Federation events. How do you start nothing, A, and B, avoid a turf war in order to find these people to start with?
Question specifically for Rachel. How do you allocate your time, I imagine, as the single rabbi in your community? How do you split yourself between your kiruv work described here, and what your Balabatim want from you, and how did you mindfully plant that seed with your Balabatim to make them understand that it was worth your time?
Reuben.
Hi, Reuben Barkin from Savannah. What do you think about the word conservative? Do you use that in your settings? What do you think about the word conservative for our movement, since people have weighed in on that at times? And back to your settings, thinking about the word conservative in the sense that it sounds like authenticity and going back to the sources and having a traditional sense actually has an appeal. So, and what does it do, liberal conservative, all those things?
Terrific. Thank you all. I'm going to read through the list of questions as I got them, and you'll do what you can do, is my request, okay? Larry asked, are boomers too old to do the integration you're doing? And also wondering about how a suburban institution can survive where it requires membership income if the whole thrust of your efforts are reaching out. And David's question about getting buy-in from Shul leadership, I think, pointed in the same direction, as did, David, your question about splitting time. Who was it? Andy, I think. No, yeah, I think it was you, Andy, who was asking really about the sustainability of the model of DIY lay volunteer leadership. What's the stability of it for the organizations? Wonderful question, dating within the group, right, where it's so socially focused. What is the impact of dating on the dynamics
of the group?
Or
dating the rabbi.
wonderful question about what goes on during the week, right? Does Judaism, are they Jewish during the week as well? Relationship with Chabad, turf wars with other institutions in town, and I think, and Reuven's questions about conservative, right? What do we do with that label, and so on. So wonderful question. Go for it.
The most frequent thing that I get told about Makom from people older, I will say, than most of the people we engage with, is how nice our young singles group is. And that's funny to me on many levels. One is because actually most of the people we work with are not single, and many are either in serious long-term relationships or married. But the expectation is that what we're trying to do is actually just is actually replicate what happened 50 years ago in terms of a young singles group to do matchmaking, so that then people can be in partners, be in partnered relationships, and join a synagogue. It just so happens concurrently. My most important thought partner and builder in terms of founding Makom is a young woman who I met like the day after my first day in Dallas, who 5 months ago agreed to marry me. So, thank you. We didn't meet through Makom, but our relationship certainly was built in many ways building Makom, and she's part of our leadership team, and Danielle's been instrumental in our leadership team since the start, and is our director of creativity and engagement. People within Makom date and date each other, and Some of that, we've had many makom marriages already. We hope to have more. That's not our goal. Our goal is to connect people on every level of what that means. But dating's, you know, if people meet people and they do it through us, that's something we're happy to help make happen.
Great.
I'm going to address the baby boomer question. So I've actually thought about that too, because I'm older than David and Lizzie. And so I'm 40. So I'm out of this demographic now. Totally. And I officially, I think that this whatever millennial demographic is actually through age 32, I think is the case. About 32, 33. So I've thought about that too. But I think that at the end of the day, this is really about relationship building. That's what this is about. And all of us can build relationships no matter how old we are. We're rabbis, so we're not part of the group. I mean, we may be, we're visionaries for the group. We're leading the group, but I don't think we need to be part of the group in terms of the age bracket. I think that it may be helpful, but I really believe that if we're relationship builders and we're teachers and we're spiritual leaders, then we can continue to do this work, and that age does not have to be a factor.
I agree with you, Raquel, and something that we were talking about earlier in terms of authenticity, I think is an important dimension of the conversation that makes very real the concern that people have when I'm 50, I'm 60, these people aren't my demographic. I think absolutely, in terms of doing outreach and teaching good Torah, you can be people's rabbi. There's no question about that. I think the question is, where is your fire coming from? You have a passion for connecting with young adults. Where is your fire actually for connecting with people closer to your own age, or people who are seniors in the community, or parents? I think the thing that Raquel and David and I share is that we're doing outreach in many ways to our peers, because those are people we have with. And, I think there's less of a, it's more of a godless in the sense of you spend your time, there's less of a work-life split, I'm to the degree that rabbis have one at all. But, the time that we spend with the communities that we build is personal time, is my time. These are our people. So I think a real question to ask is, how much of the time that you're spending rabbiing is going into developing these relationships because you really feel passion and fire for it? Or is there some sense that, we have to do this because it's the future of the synagogue, or it might be the future of the synagogue, when it's really not your passion? Because then I think it's really important to find somebody whose passion it is to do it. Otherwise, where's that fire coming from?
Aaron
Caber, Bethel, New Jersey, soon to be at Newtown, Pennsylvania. I haven't heard a lot. I walked in late. I realized interfaith couples, interfaith families. In my experience, where I'm seeing a lot of interfaith families come into my synagogue, come into my preschool, and then leave because, we think reform's easier, or it's this or that. How have we broken down sort of the stereotypes and what I perceive to be a strike against us as a conservative synagogue for Reformed families, even considering conservative synagogues, interfaith families considering a place that would be their sacred makom? How have you dealt with that and broken those barriers down?
So I want to address that, and then I'll address also, there was another question. I know we haven't addressed a lot of the questions, but about sort of what I do. So I'm actually an associate rabbi now, and I'm going on to be a senior rabbi with a cantor. And in that situation, so right now I'm an associate rabbi, so there is another rabbi who I work with. So in terms of splitting my time, it will be less of an issue than it is next year. However, the shul that's hired me was very clear that they were very excited about what I do, who I am, because of sort of my vision for satellites. So we're going to see how that plays out. I mean, we're going to see how a lot plays out, right? It's very exciting, and there's also a lot to be determined. The question that you just asked, so interfaith. So what I have found is that through the use of transliteration, through the use of being a, or through the just the model of being a welcoming presence as a rabbi, and creating a model of an incredibly welcoming and engaging community, that the issue of interfaith and the issue of whether my sort of non-Jewish spouse is going to be comfortable becomes less of a problem. I like to say that in Judaism, that it's very rare that I've ever heard, if ever, anybody leave a shul saying, wow, that English responsive reading really moved me, right? Like, you just don't hear that. So when people say, like, I'm going to go to a Reform synagogue because there's more English, like, what does that really mean? Is that English going to be inspiring English, or is that because you want to be able to be on the page and participate? I actually think that English is oftentimes really counterintuitive to our participation, because when we really read what the English is in the Siddur, we're like, heck, I don't know if I actually believe this, you know? And so I've found that with interfaith families, that they're often quite comfortable, as long as they get what's happening and there are guideposts to guide them through the service, they're actually quite happy with a Hebrew service, as long as they feel genuinely welcomed.
There were a few questions that we have the list here of all the questions. I wanted to actually add, the question asked of Rachel about her time and her portfolio is a question that we've also had to wrestle with here, because what's happened, I have internal responsibilities in Sherith, like any of the associate rabbis there. And Makom, at least in formulation of creating my job, was going to be a little small side gig. What we've come to realize, especially in the last few months, is that Makom in and of itself is more than a full-time gig. It's just a matter of reformulating what my time looks like and how those hours are spent differently than one might expect someone inside of a congregation to do. And so now the learning curve and actually the transformation curve is for Sherith itself to try and figure out if they can become okay with me spending my time differently than they had originally wanted to, because I can't actually do both anymore. And that actually requires a level of self-reflection for Sherith, because Sherith believes in the project and is happy with the fruits of the labor, and now has to actually come to terms with what the cost is, which is I can't be in two places at one time. There was also a question about Chabad, which here in Dallas is a story. But to make the story short, one of the other pieces that one should know about the Dallas community is that 5 years ago, one Chabad rabbi basically set up shop in this urban core in a part specifically called Uptown, just north of downtown, and built in a former bookstore his Chabad house, which became, for many Jews, their sole in Jewish experience in between college and joining a shul. And so for some people who are interested in helping Makom to succeed, what we're doing is actually creating, stopping this process which we found, which is a whole generation of unempowered Jews are sort of put in this holding pattern of social events through Chabad down in Uptown, and then 10 years later join a synagogue, totally disenfranchised, disengaged, and just perpetuating the same cycle. What we did is actually build that community, and very quickly I was seen personally as a severe threat to that institution. Because, thank you, I think, but because ultimately what we said, what we will not stand for, right, I will not stand for the fact that that most of the major donors to Chabad in Dallas, or Chabad, the Chabad engaging young adults in Dallas, are my congregants. And as we built something that they were persuaded by and excited by, that actually put a threat on his revenue system, and made me and my fiance actually personal targets of hate, to try and wash what we're doing as actually divisive to the community. We got past that point, but what we realized is that one of the things we had to do was actually beat Chabad at its own game, yeah, that's
Chabad. I don't know how many of you know Ed Bernstein, but he's the single nicest guy in the world, so he gets to ask a question too.
Yeah, that's okay. The question that popped into mind listening to this fascinating discussion ritual garb. We talk about come as you are in terms of dress code, but what do you do about, say, kippot, and if you have a morning service, talit? What are your gender expectations? If you see a man not wearing a kippah, do you hand him one? What is your protocol for that?
Take it first.
We have makom kippot. They're basketball mesh. They're kind of cool. Some guy here has a patent on them, but he made them for us. But I will never hand a kippah to someone unless they ask me to hand them a kippah. And if they want to wear one, I will encourage that and support that. I mean, I think that actually connects to the halacha question, right? When Shabbat is ready to start, I will announce to the people who have come early to help draw on the walls that, hey guys, Shabbat's about to start, we're going to put away the markers. Because that's sort of what we do to create that space. At the same time, I don't want someone who's coming to a Shabbat anything with makom to pretend like they're not going out afterwards to the bar. Right? If they're not, they shouldn't pretend that they are. But I don't want us to play make-believe and act like we're all a level firmer than we are, or in any way observing like we're not. What I think my ability to do as a rabbi is to invite people to walk down a path of mitzvot, and to go there with me, or to go there without me. But I will not impose it on anyone, and I certainly, again, won't tell a should or a have to.
So we have kippot out, and if it's high holidays or Shabbat morning, experience, then we have talit out as well. When I lead, I wear a talit and I wear a head covering. But it's very similar to what David said. I wouldn't go up to somebody and suggest that they put one on. And I wanted to address, there's another question here, something about shul leadership. I just wanted to address that clearly in order to do this, I needed to have tremendous buy-in from my congregation. I repeatedly went to my senior rabbi, Neil Blumhoff, who is not here right now, but was here earlier, and thought that, I started a number of different initiatives when I got to my shul. I started a Shabbat morning chavurah minyan, which was sort of Karlbach style, a bunch of different things. And each time I did it, I thought, this is going to be, the final thing, that it's going to be, this is too out of the box. And never once did he say no. I mean, he saw, you are sort of an entrepreneurial rabbi type. This is what's going to, work for you, and I'm going to support you, and I'm going to lead a community and a board that supports you and that buys into that this is good for the Jewish people. And that eventually, that this is good for us as a community too. It doesn't have to translate into money and membership being good, but it is good for us as a community because it is good for us as a Jewish people.
Terrific. And, we are out of time. Yeah. I'm sorry.
We didn't answer.
No, I know.
Lizzie.
No, Lizzie, any parting comment?
You know what? In response to the question about, do you give people talitot or kippot, we actually, if there's somebody who's free and can, we have somebody standing next to the kippot and talitot, especially on Shabbat morning, that offers to teach people if you want to learn how to put this on. And so many people take them up on that, because I think so many people just never learned or forgot, and to offer the opportunity to learn again in a non-judgmental space is a really important thing that we can do. So, on the one hand, I totally get it. I also don't want to err on the side that are pushing people toward anything, but it's a fine dance with not pushing, but also enabling people to learn about something so that, they can do it. So that's the only thing I would add to the conversation we just had, but I think...
That's really beautiful. Can I just answer one thing that hasn't been touched on, and that's about leadership. So we have, just very quickly, we have a davening leadership team. So we have this sort of ensemble of instrumentalists, drummers, flute player, violinist, guitar player. In addition to that, we have prayer leaders. So it's not just me. I love to sing. I don't have the greatest voice. We have people who have awesome voices that partner with me in leading prayer. And we also have a board for Sela. We also have coordinators for ATX Chavura, and for Tat Shabbat, I have a woman who's a guitar player, song leader type, who leads with me. And, I didn't touch on that more. I wanted to touch on that more, but that I really feel is a huge way of bringing young adults back into the shul.
Great. So. Folks, you guys have been great. We're out of time. I've got to respect your time. We've got to move on. So, number one, thank you. Number two, all of them are obviously accessible, and I encourage everyone here in the Kahal to follow up with each of them and learn more. Number three is please have a look at this Pew report, which is there's stacks of them on the table there. Maybe bring a few back for your board. Two comments about this Pew report. Number one, this is a great counterbalance to the Pew report we all read back in October. It's not just about us. It's not our failure. It is a transformation in attitudes and orientations and affiliations that is countrywide. As David said to me just before, what the Pew report of October compared with this report affirms is that who are we, the conservative Jewish community, the American Jewish community? We're Americans. We're Americans. That's who we are. The story of the Pew Report is not about the doom of the conservative movement, but it certainly poses particular challenges to us. And so, and the final point is have a look on the inside of the report. There is surprising news in here. There is encouraging news in here. The folks our panelists have been talking about, according to the demographics, are remarkably upbeat. Are remarkably focused on what can be accomplished in the world, about making the world a better place. What a great thing to know about a group of people. And so on. There's much more to say, but we are out of time. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, Joel.